You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
I want to welcome everyone who's on the call already to this Shift in Action program. We return to Entangled Minds tonight with Dean Radin, and we're very excited to be hosting Nassim Haramein, who was one of the people who sparked the most buzz at our last conference and is doing incredible work at the frontiers of physics. I personally attended a 12-hour workshop. It was one of the most mind-blowing things that I've experienced. So look forward to this tonight's call, and I'll turn it over to Dean and Nassim for about the next 40 minutes before we open for questions and answers. Take it away, Dean.
Thank you. I've read Nassim's paper, your paper, The Origin of Spin, the one from the Noetic Journal.
Yes.
And by the way, the Noetic Journal is not part of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. It just happens to have a similar name. The paper is not the sort of thing you would want to lightly begin to read, because it goes into mathematics that would make most people fall asleep very quickly. But I understand it enough. I understand what you've done enough here to actually, it's quite impressive, to include the notion of torque into Coriolis forces into Einstein's field equations. So for those people who are listening who are not very familiar with either Einstein's field equations or considerations of torque and Coriolis, how would you explain to a layperson what it is that you've developed here?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, you know, definitely the paper that was published in Noetic Journal is not a layman paper. So, yeah, it would probably put a layman to sleep very quickly and might arouse some interest in a physicist type person, however. Definitely, you know, although the equations and the formalism for Einstein field equations and certainly adding terms to it is complex, really the fundamental principles of it are simple, and they are principles that everybody experience every day, driving their car, and in many, many different situations in which a certain force is applied to produce angular momentum, to produce spin, or to produce the result of the wheels of your car turning and bringing you somewhere. And so basically what we've done, and this is the result of some 20 years of investigation I've done in physics, is that I realized that it seemed like there was first of all, it's good for the listeners to know that physics are split between a certain set of physics we call quantum theory or quantum mechanics that describe the fundamental structure of particles and subatomic structures and atoms and all this, and a set of physics that describe things like large objects, stars, galaxies, planets, suns, and the dynamics of all these objects together. And this split is something that many, many physicists, including Einstein, have tried to overcome throughout the years, and that is thought to be a field of research described as a unified field theory, trying to find a unified theory that would unify the big and the small. So that was what I was on researching for many, many years, and my approach was unconventional. I researched a lot of ancient civilization, ancient culture, and all this. Interestingly, person like Isaac Newton took the same path, studied a lot of ancient civilization before he wrote anything in physics. In any case, I realized that there was some fundamental thing that seemed to be missing to our current physics, both in the equations to describe the small stuff in the quantum equations and in Einstein field equations that describes the big stuff. And the thing I was missing, I felt, was really fundamental, and that thing is how does things spin? What is making? What's the source of the spin of big galaxies and stars and planets and suns and so on? And what is the source of the spin that makes the electron spin, the subatomic particle spin, and so on? What is keeping all this stuff going? And as far as I could tell, the answer I was getting from the current theories was not adequate. The answer was, in general, that everything had started spinning in the Big Bang, and that it was going to continue spinning to infinity because it was a conserved energy spinning in a frictionless environment, meaning, like, assuming that the universe out there is frictionless in a perfect, ideal environment, things could start spinning in the Big Bang, and they could spin forever. But as we know, that is a very large generalization, and actually the world out there is not frictionless at all. There's a lot of interaction between objects. There's a lot of plasma in space. There's a lot of interactions such as gravitational interaction, electromagnetic interaction, all sorts of things that would stop objects from spinning. So I was surprised to find that nobody had really fundamentally addressed that issue. And I realized that the way to address it would be to add a fundamental force in our space-time concepts described by Einstein, and having that force be a torque term, a force of torque, which is an energy potential that creates spin, as, for instance, your motor in your car produces torque on a shaft which spins the wheels of your car. And that actually our current physics had omitted to describe that force, to describe that potential energy, and to include it in our equations. And I believe that's why when we end at the end of the equations, when we look at our universe, we're missing currently 96% the mass of our universe. I don't think it's because there's some kind of weird animal out there we call dark matter. Actually, that we are looking at the result of space-time torque. The energy that's missing is because we haven't calculated all the energy necessary to spin all that stuff into action, to spin it all into a galaxy or into a star or into a planet and so on. So that's what we did. Now, a way to visualize that that makes it really kind of easy and visually appealing is imagine a trampoline, a surface of a trampoline, and imagine you put a heavy ball in the middle of it. Let's say that ball was our sun. And let's say you put another ball on the trampoline. Because the first ball is heavy, it would bend the surface of the trampoline, and that's what's thought to be space-time curvature. That's what Einstein described in his famous equations of general relativity. And he said, really, gravity is not a force inside the object, but gravity is a force resulting from space curving, like the surface of the trampoline, and then the other balls get attracted to that first ball because there's a large curvature there, and it's falling into it kind of deal. Now, what our equations have done is, and this is really a simplistic way of visualizing it, but it gives you an idea. And what our equations really have done is that we've basically said, well, actually, when the space-time curves like that, it doesn't curve straight in towards the ball, but it spins as it curves, just like water going down the drain spins as it goes down the drain and as air comes out of it. And we'll talk about the air part coming out of it a little later on. But really, this is what we said. We said that actually when gravity is produced at the same time, a torque force is applied to the system, which makes it spin. And, you know, although this may seem like a simple change and a simple concept, because Einstein field equations are some of the most complex equations on Earth, and because spin components are non-linear components and they're solved in fluid dynamics and all this, it gets a little complicated. But the other thing that happens is when you add the torque to the space-time manifold as like a potential energy, then the result is that you get this spinning space-time that produces Coriolis effects. And Coriolis effects are just like the Coriolis effects that are produced on Earth by the result of the Earth spinning. It makes the weather system rotate in opposite direction in the north and south poles. It makes the water go down the drain in the opposite direction in north and south pole. It's the result of the difference of speed of rotation between the equator of an object and its poles. And because there's a change in speed of rotation, it creates all these vortices, all these vortex that are spinning in opposite direction in different hemispheres. So that has to be calculated too. And so all of a sudden, although this change seems light, and it seems that it wouldn't create much of a result, actually this change becomes really fundamental and really profound in our understanding of the way space-time organized, how it produces stars, planets, atoms, subatomic particle, and all of this. What's exciting about that, too, is that when you do this, when you add the torque and the Coriolis forces and you solve Einstein equations like that, you produce a different type of structure than the perfect sphere you would expect to get from, for instance, solving Einstein field equations for a black hole, which produces a sphere. In this case, it doesn't produce a sphere, it produces a pseudosphere, a sphere that actually has two vortices at the north and south pole that meet in the center and produces a double torus. And a torus is like a donut, and it's like, imagine two donuts, one on top of each other, and spinning in opposite direction, and that is really a big, profound change in our current understanding of physics. When we look at the double torus and at the solution of Einstein field equation with the addition of torque and Coriolis forces, and we solve it all the way down to the atomic structure, all of a sudden we're able to connect quantum theory and relativistic equation with group theoretical models, and it produces a very elegant, unified view of physics. It's very exciting. We're writing much more papers and much more mathematics on it because obviously much more has to be done. But currently, it's looking really good, and we're getting a lot of really good response and interest, and that's where we're at. And it has implication as well into consciousness theory and so on. So that's really what we've done.
Okay, but now you've left us with many more questions, which have to be followed up.
Yes.
Which is good. That's a good overview. And I noticed that you do have on your website a layman's description, which is similar to what you just said. When I read that and I read your journal article, I had a number of questions that came to mind. For example, are you proposing that torque is a fundamental force, or is it a consequence of differences in starting conditions? In other words, if you use your metaphor of a bowling ball and a trampoline,
mm-hmm.
It is because, or water going down a drain, the reason why water spins going around a drain is, and rather than going in uniformly without creating a spin force, is because there are slight differences in the boundary conditions. And so the lower energy state would force the system to start rotating. So is that the idea that space-time spins because it's the lowest energy state, or is it seen as an actual fundamental force?
This can be a little bit semantic issues here. It's introduced in Einstein's field equations as a fundamental force in the stress energy tensor part of the equation. Now, I don't want to get too complex here, but what I'm the functions of that force, the result, the force. But then you could say, for instance, and I think this is where you're leading to. It's like, okay, well, where's that force coming from?
Mm-hmm.
And really, that brings us back to the Poisson-Laplace equations, which is the start of Einstein's field equation, which is equations that describe changes in density. So what I'm saying is that there's a fundamental change in density in the universe, meaning from, you know, universal size to galactic size to or to cluster size, to galactic size, to star size, to planetary size, to atomic size, and so on. And that change in density, just like the change in density that occurs when you unplug your tub and all of a sudden there's a change in density in the drain because there's air there and the density of water is higher, the air wants to move up, the water wants to go down, just As an analogy, the change in density forces this the space-time to have a spinning component that is described as a torque in a fluid dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine you got your little rubber ducky on top of the drain there, and you pull the plug on the drain, and as the spiral of the water goes down and the air comes up, the rubber ducky spins with the water towards the drain. And the rubber ducky being, you know, the bowling ball on, the planet, the star, the galaxy, the atom, the subatomic particle, whatever scale you're looking at it is. So it's used space-time with more of a viscosity and as well as true fluid dynamics. And so it's a little bit different from the conventional view of space-time.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're treating space-time in a fluid method, as though space-time acts as a fluid.
Correct, with viscosity. Currently, space-time is treated as a fluid in Einstein's field equation. However, it's thought to be non-viscous or super fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, the fluidity of space-time is described by the change in density and the change in torque potential produced by the space-time curvature of the objects that you're making a calculation on, if you'd like.
So since the torque arrives basically because of gradient differences, some number of trillions of years now, and the universe becomes more homogeneous, then the gradients will start to go away, in which case presumably the torque will go away as well.
Not quite. This view is actually a little bit more complex than that because it's associated with the dynamics that you observe at the quantum level, and as well it's associated with a different view, and you know, this is some of the stuff we're writing now, and I understand your question, you know, as a result of what you've read so far.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this view is associated with a view of the universe that is not directly related to the Big Bang. The Big Bang has a certain amount of inconsistency with Einstein's field equation. And and we resolve some of these inconsistencies by assuming a continuous creation model. And in a continuous creation model, the torque of space-time is, if you'd like, spinning off tiny vortices in the space-time fluid dynamics, producing atomic structure inside highly condensed objects like black holes.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, currently we're just on the verge of publishing papers that describe a balance equation between what goes in and what comes out, and so that there's a continuous change of density, meaning that let's go back to our drain description. So here we have water coming down the drain, and we could think of that water going down the drain as the gravitational component of space-time. And then we could think of the air that must go out of the drain in the middle of that vortex that's coming down as the electromagnetic component of space-time. So now we're making a direct relationship between how much information you can think of gravity going inside the system as information moving in, how much information is going in, and how much information is coming out, being a balance, and this is a dynamic balance that's continuous between the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field. And so that there's a constant and infinite potential of density change that continuously produces the result of that feedback between the gravitational field and the electromagnetic field that drives everything that we observe in a continuous manner. And what we experience mostly in our universe, what we experience mostly in our physics, is what comes out, the electromagnetic field and the entropic part of the equation. But we're linking this with what I call the centropic part, what goes towards the center, what coheres to singularity in the middle of the system, the gravitational field going back into the system. And as the information goes through this dynamic loop of information, that dynamic feedback, system basically learns about itself, and that is where it leads to more advanced concepts of how physics and how the forces of physics could eventually generate systems that are self-aware, like a human being having consciousness. But that's a little bit more off subject right now.
So this is the link back into something like consciousness. It's the feedback system which you're proposing is built into the fabric of space-time.
Yeah, of space itself and the dynamics of the radiation component of that space is what we observe as, for instance, a star radiating, a sun radiating, a planet radiating heat, or even an atom absorbing and emitting photons and so on. That feedback of dynamic of creation is really a feedback between the electromagnetic field and the gravitational field, and that is fundamental to both the dynamics of space-time, meaning how creation comes to be. There's large discrepancy, for instance, in the way we are able to describe the dynamics of a galaxy. We have a lot of problems in being able to describe how a galaxy comes together, why it comes together so fast in the evolution of the universe, how stars form inside that galaxy, and so on. But many of these issues are resolved with this addition of torque and Coriolis forces, where the torque is really what we don't see. The torque is the space-time manifold going towards singularity, going towards the inside of the object, and the Coriolis forces really produces the electromagnetic radiation that we see in the orgosphere, in the plasma around the object, like the surface of our sun, with large Coriolis dynamics, radiating electromagnetic fields, and so on. And we can look at the atom in the same, in a similar way. It's really interesting. There's an interesting problem. There's one reason that torque was emitted, and actually that gyroscopic components were emitted out of the space-time manifold, and that is that when the space-time manifold, when you calculate when it gets really, really small, it becomes very, the velocity goes to infinity, and the torque, seems to go towards zero, and so it's called a fractional problem, because all of a sudden you got this vortex going to tighter and tighter, going to faster and faster and faster, and by the way, this is what we see when we look at black holes in our universe. We see two huge vortices at their pole going towards the center, and then we see particles radiating out of these vortices. Some of these vortices are huge. They're like 1 million light year long, at each pole. So that's like 2 million light year long axis of rotation spinning at very high velocity. So those spinning components are actually visible. But what I'm saying is that when we look at those dynamics, we see that the relationship between what comes out and what goes in may be related to the way information moves through that feedback between radiation and contraction, and the plasma dynamics we see is actually the Coriolis forces being expressed as electromagnetic fields. I don't want to get too complicated, but basically what it comes down to is that, and what's really exciting as well is that when you do this, all of a sudden you end up with only two real forces in the universe. One force pulls out, we call it the electromagnetic field, and what one force pulls in, and we call it the gravitational component, and I call it space-time torque. And when you apply that to the atom, all of a sudden the atom starts to look a little bit different. Because when the vortex gets that tight in that level of a radius, all of a sudden when you calculate the energy levels for the atom doesn't look like the conventional atom we've been thinking of, but the atom starts to look like a mini black hole. It acts like a mini black hole, and even in conventional physics currently, subatomic particles are theorized to be mini black holes, and actually one of the largest accelerators ever built is being built currently to try to isolate one of those mini black holes. And so it's not so outrageous to start to think of the atom as a mini black hole itself. And when you take the energy levels of the electron and the energy level of the atom and you plug that radius in Einstein Phil equation, the atom looks like a black hole, acts like a black hole. And let's assume for a minute that every single atom was a mini teeny weeny black hole that's the result of a little vortex in space-time, a little torque in space-time that is going towards infinite velocity because the radius is so small. And you would expect then that the electron would be spinning very, very fast. Well, we know that the electron spin is near the speed of light, 99.9999% the speed of light, whatever we can calculate. And so that's confirming. But what's really much more exciting for me is that when you look at the atom as a mini black hole, you solve one of the biggest riddles of current physics, I believe, and that is, what is the strong force? You know that earlier on in physics, they thought that when they discovered the protons, which are the little particles that makes the nuclei in the middle of a black of the atom, they found that the protons were positively charged with very strong electromagnetic field, and that these positively charged particles, just like two magnets being pushed towards each other, would want to repel at a very strong potential, called the Coulomb force.
Right.
And that instead of thinking maybe we don't understand quite what an atom is, because some force must be crushing these particles together, there must be some other way that this, you know, there must be some other way to describe the atom. Instead of doing that, in general, what happened is that we invented a new force. We called it the strong force, and we calculated how strong that force would have to be to keep these particles stuck together really, really tight in the middle of the nuclei of an atom, which is infinitesimally small. It's very, very small in the center of an atom. And so that force had to be enormous for that to happen. Well, and then we went from there. So we invented the strong force, and then we invented gluons, which is the particles that mediate that force, and we calculated how strong it had to be. And then we made accelerator to blow the protons apart from each other, and we verified that the force needed to blow them apart was equivalent to the strong force, and so we went with it. But the thing is that if all of a sudden you start to think of the atom as a mini black hole, and you calculate for the radius of a mini black hole, like let's say that there was a teeny-weeny singularity in the middle of the nuclei of a black hole, and you calculated how strong that the gravitational force would have to be in order to be able to, how strong the gravitational field would have to be at the nuclei radius of the atom, that force would be exactly the amount of force you need to hold the nuclei together without the need of a strong force. So in this case, all of a sudden, gravity would not be the weakest force in the universe, but all of a sudden would become the strongest force in the universe that we believe to be the strong force for all these years.
Hmm. I'll shift the discussion just a tiny bit here, because just recently there were a number of papers published on the spinning gyroscopes. And, of course, spinning gyroscopes and rotating black holes, which is what you're talking about, have the curious properties in one case of apparently anti-gravity, and in the other case of the possibility of time travel. So I assume that there's something relevant here about both of those science fiction ideas that fit into what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dean, for doing your homework and being on top of the pulse of what's happening out there. I'm so excited that you mentioned that. There is more and more evidence out there from experimental evidence from very serious labs out there, including the European Space Agency and NASA and so on, that when you spin things at high velocity, and especially if the objects you're spinning have a very large charge on them, like a superconductive disk or so on, that these objects all of a sudden start losing weight. Mm-hmm. And that is a violation of our current concepts of gravity. And, you know, they try to explain this away in many different ways, mostly Cooper pairs interaction and quantum effects. Because if they try to explain it with classical views of gravitation, for an object to even lose one-tenth of a hundredth of a gram by just spinning it, you know, would violate all of our current laws of physics.
Right.
So what goes on here is that, I believe, is that actually when you have an object and the object is creating enough of a charge and or has the right geometry and so on to start to entrain the fluid dynamics of space-time into some kind of Coriolis dynamics, you start to get the result, which is the curvature, like the water going down the drain, you start to get some curvature in space-time, which results in objects around starting to lose weight. So, for instance, one of the last tests they've done, they were spinning a superconducting ring at approximately 5,000 RPM, and objects in its vicinity start to lose significant amount of weight. And these objects, if they were placed in the appropriate angle relative to the device, would lose, significant.
I recall that the amazement was that it was several trillion times more than could be accounted for by simply stretching of space-time.
Exactly. So, and as you know, Dean, having been trained, the energy potential, the energy necessary to do that under classical equations would demand almost all the nuclear power plant on the planet. It would take a lot of energy to curve space-time enough to reduce these objects from that weight. And so it's very significant.
Right.
So they're starting to discover that space-time curvature may be related intrinsically and intimately with space, with rotation, with spin. And that's really exciting, because if we can start to think of space-time as spin, and we can start to move in the direction of producing effects in space-time by spinning things, that means we are really moving forward to a whole new world, a world where we could have all sorts of very exciting technologies and way of living in our universe.
I certainly agree, which is why interest in this notion of spin is beginning to heat up very quickly. Have you thought at all about since rotating black holes are one of the few ways that from classical equations we can figure out how to go through time, how does your concept relate to this?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's an interesting thing, because all of a sudden, when you start to think of space-time with this fluid dynamics and these Coriolis forces in them and so on, the picture starts to get more and more clear on what seemed to be kind of disjointed and unrelated in previous theories. And in this case, for instance, the concepts of wormholes and the concepts of black holes almost come together, not almost, actually come together, where before they thought to be different animals, you start to visualize, for instance, imagine a black hole and a singularity in the middle, and imagine all this black hole is no longer a smooth sphere. All of a sudden, this black hole, according to these equations, is this tremendously dynamic surface that has all these Coriolis dynamics, these vortices on it. And these vortices are going towards the singularity at the middle. And usually I give the analogy for people of a sunspot. If people have observed sunspots before, like a big hole on the surface of the sun that's black, that's actually a vortex going towards the center of the sun. Imagine that, and imagine that that vortex is going towards a point of infinite density, a point where all times are available, a point where all information in the universe is present, because that point has infinite density. Mm. I'd like to imagine it even, or give it a description, just so people understand better what I mean by all information. If you were to find a point in the universe, a singularity, a true singularity, where space-time curve to infinity, because the point was infinitely dense. Like, if space-time went infinitely into that hole, that point, then you could never separate that point from anything else in the universe, meaning that anything else you pick in the universe around it would be somewhere along that curve, that you know, it would be maybe very far from that, from the point, but it would be somewhere along that curve. And so that point would contain all potential information, meaning that all objects would be somewhere in the context of that point. And so imagine that vortex going towards the middle is a wormhole, and imagine that you could travel to it, you know, like a sunspot. Sunspots in some cases are, let's say, 14, 20 times the size of the Earth. You know, if there was such a sunspot, and my theory definitely predicts that there is such structures on black holes and galactic centers and all this, if you could get through, this might be a way for us to actually reach singularity, like if we could reproduce those dynamics in a system where we can create singularity, then we would have access to all other singularities in the universe, and maybe we would be able to transcend space and time that way. And you know, this is definitely far in the future, but...
You know what? Maybe it's not so far. Because if you're talking about black holes that are quite large, but if you're correct that elementary particles are also black holes, albeit small black holes, then if the where the vortex goes down to a single point, if that is the point of what we might call non-locality, then that's the natural connection back into quantum mechanics. And if it also turns out that you're right, that consciousness is a kind of recursion that occurs between gravitation and electrodynamics, then consciousness, in principle, ought to be able to have access to this non-local space as well.
Wonderful. That's exactly where I was leading to. And I'm so excited to hear it from someone else. I believe so. I truly think that even, you know, and as you said, we might not be that far away from it. And actually, we might be doing that in our everyday life, but at a much slower pace, you know, like we might be in our everyday life actually informing all things of our experience, and then all things is informing us of our expression of that experience, and we experience that as the reality outside of ourselves. So it's like a feedback between even the atomic structure we are made of and the experience of the conceptual world out there, or contextual world out there, and that feedback is actually what's driving everything, and that we might be able to, by refining our understanding, we might be able to bring that feedback to the point where we can, you know, as you're right now, you can think of your arm moving up, and your arm moves up, you're actually moving billions and billions of atoms through space-time. Maybe we can, by understanding these principles, maybe we can amplify your capacity to move atoms so that you can move your own body or a vehicle that you're controlling through space-time across the galaxy or so on.
So suddenly the traditional cities that are spoken about from Patanjali and so on, levitation and teleportation and all that, perhaps with a sufficiently refined consciousness, which can experience that level of reality, to add your intention into it. Because so far we're talking about basic fields and forces that don't have any intention. But if the universe does have a kind of intention, that the sort of thing that we recognize as our will, and we can exercise that, then I think you're right, and people should be able to fly around.
Yeah, and, you know, some masters have claimed to have done so, certainly, you know, and so on. And definitely we've experienced such unusual nonlinear dynamics and experiments in laboratories where we find that, for instance, particles that are very far apart seem to be entangled in a way where they seem to transfer information back and forth at instantaneous speeds and so on. So we know there's some kind of nonlinear possibility in there, but we don't have all the understanding of those dynamics, so we're not exploiting them in a way that really we can apply it to our day-to-day life. But I believe that that very specific understanding of these dynamics has to do with spin, angular momentum, and Coriolis dynamics, fluid dynamics. And if we understand that, we might be able to do it with our consciousness, I agree. And I believe that we may be able to produce devices that amplify our consciousness in a way that we can affect more of the space-time manifold to produce larger effects, like moving a whole object across, you know, the continent, or you know, I mean, moving like a large spaceship with hundreds of people in it across our solar system, you know. Yeah.
So, okay, so before we go to open for general questions, let's imagine that somebody comes along and says, okay, here's enough money to do an experiment which would demonstrate one or more of the aspects of what you of your theory. Have you thought about such experiments? And if so, what would you like to see someone do as an experiment?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there's many, many different ways you can actually support and learn more about space-time torque and Coriolis forces in laboratory, both in laboratory and in observation. And certainly observation is crucial. For instance, we can learn a lot about fluid dynamics and Coriolis forces that the universe, that space-time uses by observing and writing mathematics on galactic structures, fluid dynamics on stars, plasma dynamics on the surface of stars and all this. And then there's a flurry of experiments. And certainly some of these experiments that have been done so far are along that line, those lines, which could, you know, so that we could learn more and more how to help space-time coalesce into a self-constructive structure that we could control and use as, literally, space-time engineering. And that, I think, is definitely the technology of the future. And laboratories all around the world, I think, are starting to realize that, and it really is time for people, if they have such inspiration, to get involved and support efforts along these lines. Yeah, and I definitely have thought about all sorts of possibilities that could be done to bring that forward.
That's great. It's very exciting work. Do we want to go to questions now?
Sure. We'll just give a word of introduction. When we switch from presenter mode to open for questions, it means everyone's line is live, and background noise can get on unless you remute. So we ask that everybody remute unless you have a question or a comment or something to talk about. And *6 is what will remute you. So when I give the word go, just please hit *6 once to mute yourself, and if you have a question, hit *6 again to unmute yourself, say your name and where you're from. So ready? That's people didn't hear that, star 6 wants to mute yourself, and hopefully we will have enough. It can sometimes get a little bit dicey with this many people on the line, but hopefully, so if you can say your name, where are you from?
Regina Baker, Sonoma, California.
Hi, Regina.
Hi. In the analogy with the water going down the drain and the spin, my observation of the water going down my drain for 60 years has it always goes the same direction.
Yeah, correct. I'm
from Sonoma. In your analogy of the water going down the drain, my observation is that for 60 years of watching water going down a drain, is it goes in the same direction?
Right. It's correct. It goes in the same direction. Now, if all of a sudden I moved you to the south hemisphere, you would find that it goes in the other.
Right. So that's a result of the Coriolis effect.
Correct.
The hemisphere goes in the opposite direction.
Right. And the other thing is that while the water is going down the drain in one direction, the air that's coming out of the drain is going in the opposite.
The air coming out. Water goes down one direction. The air going out goes in the other direction.
There's somebody who's repeating what was just said that I think you need to remute, star 6.
Thank you.
I'm listening.
Okay, should we have another question?
Hi, this is Saul Weingarten from Walnut Creek, California. I was wondering where inertia and... Hello? Where inertia and extra dimensions fit into your theory.
Okay, that's a big question. Well, you know, one thing, you know, that I work with co-authors, Elizabeth Lauscher and others, and, you know, one thing that drives them crazy is I always, always attempt to stay in the minimum amount of dimensions as possible.
No, they're asking questions. People are calling in.
Someone who's saying, who's speaking about the questions needs to mute star 6, please.
I just want to hear.
I'm sorry
about that, Vincent.
No problem. So basically, I you know, everything we've done in this paper that's on the internet, we've solved in 4 space. In terms of Einstein field equations, and you know, and then the group theoretical, we've used a gut theory approach. But what I'm saying, as far as dimension goes, let me just extrapolate a little bit. I would say that I think we have a fundamental error in our current physics that has dimensions. One of the errors I think we're making is we're assuming, and although I use this in my paper, I'd like to, like, expand a little bit more here and say that we're assuming that dimensions or Cartesians in nature, we assume the dot, the line, the plane, and the cube, And so we assume a flat Cartesian plane. And I just want to say that actually in order to solve those equations the way we did, we have to abandon the Minkowski flat space and go to a double torus U4 bubble. It's a little bit different. There's reasons for that. And I, you know, it gets technical and I don't want to get into it, but basically, I believe that actually dimensions are scale related. That actually what we call dimensions is nothing else than different scales of observation. Just like if you were all of a sudden an atom or a molecule, you would look at everything around you and you would think of a certain world. You would interpret the world in a very specific way, and then all of a sudden, if I actually grew you to the size of a human being, the world would look completely different, and you would think that you've gone to a new dimension, you know? And so I tend to think of dimensions in terms of scales and concentric to each other, like a sphere within a sphere within a sphere, and each sphere being a different dimension. So like atoms, planets, suns, galaxies, clusters, universes, and so on. And as far as inertia goes, what we're doing really is actually giving a moment of inertia to the spinning dynamics of everything. Instead of saying there was a moment of inertia in the Big Bang and we don't know where it came from and everything has been spinning since then, we're saying the moment of inertia is occurring everywhere all the time, and that's why it continuously spins. And actually, this is very, very helpful, for instance, to describe it, the moment of inertia of our planet. We know the magnetic field of the planet is a result of the core of the planet spinning against the mantle of our planet. Yet, we can't explain currently, in any theories that I know of, that how come, where is the angular moment for that spin to have come, or what's the magnetic moment even for that the magnetic field we have. And there comes to the rescue the space-time torque, because all of a sudden you realize that the inside of the planet, the dynamo effect that's producing the magnetic field is the result of the space-time torque applied to the surface of the planet, forcing it to spin against the mantle and producing that effect, just like a dynamo or a magnetic motor. And, you know, just like a dynamo you had on your little bicycle when you were a kid, that you would flip on the wheel of your bicycle and it would run your little light in front, that is the way we describe the magnetic field of our planet as being produced. Yet, nobody's saying who's pedaling on the bicycle, who's producing the energy to make that happen. And what we're saying here is that that energy is actually the potential torque in space-time, and that's the energy that's missing in our calculation that makes us think we're missing 96% the mass of our universe.
Hi, this is Arthur in New York City. Is there a website where this is summarized for people with a couple years of physics but not at your level?
Yeah, the resonance project .org. So it's actually the whole thing, theresonanceproject.org is where you're going to find our paper. You're going to find animations there of the space-time manifold in the double torus structure. You're going to find our solution to the vacuum structure, which is an array of 64 tetrahedrons, and they're related to the double torus. And you're going to find a layman article that describes a little bit what I've talked about today. And shortly, you will find a way to be able to buy a DVD of 6 hours of presentation that describe all of this, including all of the research I've done on ancient systems that actually led me to this understanding.
Thank you.
Nassim, you also have mentioned the book Crossing the Event Horizon. And when would you expect that will be out?
You know, we're working really diligently to get the DVD out, and the book should be out within the next year. It's in process right now. You know, I've been saying that for a while, but you know how research is.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that you just published, and I'm, congratulations on that. I look forward to reading it. Actually, I haven't read it yet. Hopefully Crossing the Event Horizon will come out within the next year, and the DVD will be out within the next few months.
Very good.
Do you have time for any more questions?
Probably one more.
Just wanted, this is Fred Wood in Bethesda, Maryland. I just have a question about the relationship with ancient codes left in monuments, sacred geometry. That's mentioned in the intro here. Maybe you could just talk briefly about that, and if you have a paper on that aspect.
Yes. I haven't published papers on that aspect yet, but it will be included in the DVD, actually. Two of the four DVDs packets will be on ancient civilization. There's a bunch of stuff. It's really, you know, but quickly, if I were to summarize it, it seems pretty clear to me that ancient civilization that might have been, you know, lost in their culture right now, and that much of the information of that of what made those function have been lost, related to the Egyptian, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Indians, that all of the, if you study deeply the civilization, one thing that becomes strikingly obvious, they were somehow able to move very large objects with apparent ease, and, you know, and assemble them in very precise things and monuments and temples, and that and more.
Oh, we seem to, seems the universe is not wanting us to get this piece today, but definitely. So, Sam, I don't know if you can still hear, but you're kind of we've lost your voice at this point.
I just stopped because there was a noise. But
oh, okay.
Let me just finish this. So basically, that like this, if you don't mind, just that that. You know, and then the other thing that's striking when you study these ancient civilizations is that they seem to have all agreed on a very specific description of the fundamental forces of creation, if you'd like. They all seem to tend to want to build pyramidal structure, very specific geometric structure. They all seem to have described the forces of nature as some kind of fluid spinning type of force that cohere everything into existence. If you actually dig and you start to study these things, all of a sudden it seems like you start to get the picture of everything that I've been describing in advanced physics just now. And so I believe that these civilization may, and maybe even civilization that predates those ancient civilization that would be just kind of the residual of that earlier civilization that was maybe much more advanced than what we are today, because they were able to move objects that are larger than what we can even move today. Maybe these civilization have a fundamental understanding of these forces in nature, and we're able to use them to their advantage. And so I think it's really important and exciting for us to rediscover that and maybe get a little bit different view of history that way.
Fantastic.
I would just add onto that, I don't know whether you've run across it or not, but the descriptions of the kundalini energies and similar ideas like prana and so on are often associated with spin force. And the spin force is not explained, but nevertheless it is typically described as having some kind of a circular or spinning force to it.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And these descriptions are usually very fundamental in, as like the described as a fundamental force of creation, a fundamental force of life, and, for instance, the Buddha is represented with kundalini vortices, along its the center of his body, coming from the ground and coming from above, and so on. And you see that as well in the Mayan tradition, the Inca tradition. The Unapku in the Mayan tradition is a good example. The yin-yang in the Chinese description is as well a good example, and so on. So, yeah, absolutely. Very good, Dean.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, do you want to wrap up the formal part of the hour, Dean? And we can move into community time after this to continue the discussion. I don't know whether either Dean or Nassim has any time to stick around, you're welcome to, or people can just continue the discussion afterwards. But Dean, if you want to wrap up.
Well, I'd just like to thank Nassim very much for a very stimulating hour, and I hope everyone will go to visit his website. Again, it's theresonanceproject.org, and you can find everything you've heard and much more. And I think, I'm sure we'll all look forward to the DVD. I certainly will. And I would recommend, Nassim, that you finish your book first before you start reading my book. And the reason is so that you don't become distracted, because I know how easy it is to become distracted when you're working on something like a big project. And I think having your book out there would be quite important.
Thank you. I appreciate very much, Dean. And I appreciate all you guys, what you guys are doing out there, and I'm really honored to be part of this. And you guys are doing great work, and thank you, Steve, for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you, Nassim. And I look forward to hopefully you guys can continue your dialogues and see what else emerges between the work you're doing in parallel. I think it'd be very interesting.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.